Anthony, I Googled your name, and when I did so, a list came up of people that it said, people who Googled you also Googled this name. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. I'm curious to know who they came up with.
Well, it's a pretty impressive list. It had Melissa Scott, Louise Penny, James Baldwin, Oscar Wilde. You are incredibly good company. But my favorite one is one of the first names on the list, which is a Canadian icon. John Candy was there. So I must say, it must be an honor to be included on a list of such a fine, upstanding Canadian comedian.
Yes, it really is. Actually, just that whole list that blows me away. But you know, Brad, unless you're on the list, I mean, what's the point, really?
And you know what? I was heartbroken. And I got to say, I Googled my name and I had no such list. So I don't know what that was about.
Obviously, the internet is broken.
I had a little, you know, my own little thing on the side like you do, but I didn't have that list. So that was a bit disappointing. So my guest today is Anthony Bedulca, and while we aren't here to discuss John Candy, we have plenty to talk about, including the soon-to-be-released Going to Beautiful, which is his first crime novel in a number of years, and that is coming right up.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shree.
Hi, this is Brad, and again, welcome to Queer Writers of Crime. As I said in the opening, my guest is Anthony Bedulca. And Anthony, to start with, this show is about crime fiction, but crime fiction is one form of storytelling. And we are going to talk about books. Obviously, that's what the show is about. Most specifically, we're going to talk about the upcoming release of Going to Beautiful. But there's another story I'd like you to tell me. It's one that blew me away. And in fact, you may recall after you told me about this, I sent you an email to tell you that you are my latest crush. And we agreed we wouldn't tell our husbands.
I think you said only crush, Brad.
Well, you know, Ryan Reynolds is in there as well, but yeah, you know, you're in good company. You're in good company. If you're in there with Ryan Reynolds, be very happy.
I'll take it.
And hey, it's another Canadian. I must have things with Canadians.
Yes, exactly.
What it's about is I want you to tell the story about Camp Firefly.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking, Brad. Camp Firefly, I love talking about it because it is so intertwined with my wedding to my husband Herb, and it kind of, so this goes back to like the early 2000s, and Herb and I had heard about something called Camp Firefly. It had just sort of started in Alberta, which is the province over from where I live, and even though it's called a camp, it's not a camp at all. It's more like a life skill and leadership retreat for LGBTQ plus youth in the range of 14 to 24. Herb and I heard about it. We just loved everything we heard, but thought, you know, we got to go check this out to see if it's delivering what they promise. So we went and spent a weekend at the camp, and it just blew us away what was happening there. Right about that time, we were getting married, was becoming legal in Canada, and we decided to tie the knot. And of course, we'd already been together for decades by then, so we didn't need another toaster. So we had people, if they wanted to give us money to support bringing the camp to Saskatchewan. And we raised so much money, we were able to bring the camp to Saskatchewan the next year. The thing with that camp, Brad, that has always blown me away is that what happens is that you get youth from various different backgrounds, and particularly in Saskatchewan and really Canada overall, we're so spread out, and there are so many, you know, LGBTQ youth that are in small towns who feel alone. And for a few days, we bring them into this camp, and suddenly they are in the majority. The very first day when the kids come to camp, you see them sort of gathering in this room, and the first thing they do is they have them introduce themselves to the group. And they're all sitting there with their heads down, oftentimes with their hoodies pulled over their eyes. You can barely hear what they're saying. When you return in 5 days at the end of the camp when they're saying their goodbyes, it's like an entirely different group of individuals. It's an empowering 4 or 5 days. And, you know, we focus on five different things. Like, one is teaching them how to build the community that they're in when they go back to it. There's a leadership track. There's, you know, education through social development. There's education through arts. And then there's a whole resiliency section. And what we do is we bring in professionals from the community to lead these workshops. And now camp has been around for almost 15 years. And so some of our first campers are now coming back as workshop facilitators and leaders. And that's just an amazing thing to witness.
Wow. It is something that I'm sure you and I couldn't even imagine existing when we were that age.
Well, you're exactly right. And that's what drew us to it, because we thought if we had that when we were 14 years old, our lives would have been so much better. You know, you've heard the whole it gets better thing, and this is an embodiment of it gets better. And I know that we have saved lives by doing this, because at the camp we always have a full-time medical professional and a full-time mental health professional, and they are busy, because one of the, I guess, effects of putting these youth in this environment, which I didn't expect at first, is that when they're given the freedom to be themselves and to see other people like them, it just releases so many emotions and so many things that they've often just, you know, kept deep inside of them. And that can be really volatile. You know, I think you know the stats as well as I do as far as the rates of suicides for LGBTQ youth. And it becomes very obvious why that happens during camp. And, you know, I think one of the things that's, I think we've noticed that has changed over the, you know, decade plus that we've been doing this, is that the kids that we had coming to the first years of camp were, I mean, I kind of hate to even put it this way, but they were just your typical, you know, gay boys and lesbian girls. And yeah. Now it's, you know, our typical camper today is, you know, a 13-year-old two-spirit kid from northern Saskatchewan, or a trans girl from a different city. There's so many different ways to be queer today, and it's all showing up at camp.
I don't live in Saskatoon, but it is a small world, and I just want to say thank you.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
I said recently on this show that only one person has ever turned me down to be a guest. And actually, I realized that wasn't true. I've had three people. One of them was you. And the first person was just nervous as hell. Just, I can't do it. Later, they called back and said, you know, I think I can do it. And they became a guest. And actually, we're a brilliant guest. And I asked you, and you said, well, you know, I haven't written a mystery in a decade. And I don't know why. I said, oh, I didn't realize it'd been that long. And I let the conversation drop. And I thought maybe 6 months later, I said, I talk to people that haven't written books in ages. I don't know why I just let that go. But I didn't reach back out to you. And then in January, you sent a message to me and said, hey, I got this book coming out. So thank you. I'm glad you reached back out to me after I dropped the ball and just said, okay.
Well, really, Brad, it's the only reason I wrote this book was just to get your attention again.
Yes, because this show is so groundbreaking that everybody
groundbreaking,
has,
Brad.
Oh, everybody has to be on
no
it.
No false yeah. modesty, please. You do good work here, believe me.
Well, thank you. I love what I'm doing. So when I'm editing, I don't love it so much, but I love the discussion part.
Yes.
The editing is a necessary evil.
Now, do you find the same thing when you're writing, like when you're editing your work? Do you dislike that process too?
Not as much, okay. No. It's a different process, because with editing a podcast, it's more mechanical. So, let me just toss something out there. our discussion here is when we're done, you're going to be on one track and I'll be on another track. And that's beautiful because if I'm talking and you sneeze, I can take your sneeze out of there. But there's a lot of sound quality I've got to do. And sometimes somebody's voice level is too low and I have to raise it. And it's much more that kind of stuff. Yes. So it's not the same.
No, I understand.
Editing a book, when I'm improving it, that's a good feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
usually.
I get
You can get more information about episodes, plus scoops on book releases and promotions by LGBTQ crime authors each and every week. Simply head over to queerwritersofcrime.com and sign up for the newsletter. Brad made it easy and put the link right here in the show notes. Need a little nudge? Click it now and you'll also get a free ebook by one of a select group of outstanding authors. That makes not subscribing just plain silly. It's all yours at queerwritersofcrime.com.
When I asked you to be on the show and you said you hadn't been on and you haven't written a book in a while, and now you've reached out and you said, hey, I got a new book. First of all, why did you stop?
Yes. Well, it wasn't 10 years, but I mean, I probably haven't published a book. Like by the time this book comes out, it will have been, I think, 5 or 6 years since my last published book. You know, there's a number of reasons. I think, first of all, I kind of wanted to get off the treadmill a little. And, you know, when you're writing, particularly when you're writing series books, as I did early in my career with the Russell Quant books, you're getting out a book once a year, once every year and a half. And, you know, tied to that is not just the writing of the book, but then you go on tour and you do all the media and the publicity. And it's, you know, it's fun. And I really do love doing all of that. But it keeps you really busy, particularly if you've got other things in your life that are also keeping you busy. And I had finished the Russell Quant series at book 8. And about that time, I really started thinking about what do I want to write next? And I've always wanted to kind of stretch my writing muscles and try different types of writing. Like I've always wanted to try and write a romance novel or a Western or try something a little bit more literary or, you know, who knows? Like it was time for me to try something different. I didn't listen to myself right away. I wrote two kind of mystery / thrillers after Russell Quant. And by time that was done, there are some things happening in life that we all kind of go through, you know, aging parents, there's death in my family, there was health issues, like between Herb and I, we have 3 brand new hips. So a lot was going on. And then, you know, the pandemic comes along. And what I found with myself is that I need to write from a place of joy. And if I'm not finding a lot of joy in my life, if there's a lot of darker, heavier things happening, I have a hard time getting inspired to sit at my desk and create. So when I was ready to get back to writing mystery and conceptualizing, working on Going to Beautiful, that really was the seed of that novel. It was wanting to return to the joy of writing. And I didn't want to write about the pandemic because I'm sure there's going to be plenty of books that are going to be, you know, written about the pandemic, either from a historical perspective or a fictional perspective. I didn't feel like I wanted to write about that, but I wanted to write something that, in the hopes that when this book came out, originally I kind of thought, you know, when this book comes out, the pandemic will be far in our rearview mirror, which of course it is not. But I wanted to write something that could perhaps be a bit of a tonic or an antidote to, you know, all the joylessness that we've all collectively gone through. Like I think in talking to people, there's a lot of loss or feeling of loss out there. And I wanted to write about joy.
Going to that, I'm going to guess based on the book, it's not as joyful as you would like it to be, given current events. But first, I'm going to do what I call beyond the blurb. We can read your blurb. I want you to tell us more than that, as much as you can possibly tell when it comes to a mystery or thriller or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Going to Beautiful begins with us meeting a couple. So there's Jake Hardy, who is a celebrity chef, and his husband, Eddie Kravitz, who is a fashion designer. And the two of them have, beyond talent, they have reality TV to thank for their level of fame. Jake through TV cooking shows, and Eddie Kravitz was the winner of a competition show, probably not that different from Project Runway. And they have a wonderful life. They've been married for 30 years. They have a grown son named Connor. They have a great little French bulldog named Lulu. They seem to have it all. And it seems like they are living a fairy tale, and they are. And I think we're all familiar with fairy tales and that requisite happily ever after. Going to Beautiful begins where the fairy tale ends. So, you know, without giving too much away, there is a tragedy that befalls this couple. And the book begins certainly with a great deal of loss and grief and a murder, which may or may not be a murder, and two or three more murders throughout the course of the book. But really, Brad, I think going back to what I said earlier, this book really is about overcoming tragedy and overcoming grief and seeking joy and finding hope where you least expect it. I wanted to write something that really reflected a friendlier world than we're all living in right now. And this book, I think, when you asked me earlier about, you know, why did I stop writing for a while and why did I come back, I always believe that it's really important as writers to ask ourselves, why do we write? And you probably know, it's not an easy question to answer. And it gets complicated too, because the answer changes as you grow and develop as a person and as a writer. I think took that time off to really solidify my why. And it's about wanting to tell stories that are about underrepresented characters in underrepresented settings and tell it in a way that's accessible and entertaining. And this book hits all of those points. And it really, I think of any book I've ever written, it's the most personal book. It deals with a lot of things that have happened in my life, and I think probably have happened in other people's lives, that are not necessarily always the best thing, that there is grief in people's life and there is loss and there's dealing with aging parents but there's joy to be found too. And I really am, you know, hope I have communicated that in this book.
When did you have the final edit to submit to your publisher?
I would say probably a final edit probably went in maybe like 5 months ago, something like that, about when we were creating the ARCs, the advanced review copies.
And the reason I ask is, I know you're not necessarily a political discussion person, but I'm sure this is very on a personal level, with you kind of having this, wanting this book to bring out some of the positivity in life. You are half Irish, half Ukraine, correct?
No, but very good. You know who you're describing? You're describing Russell Quant.
Yes, I am. Okay. So I assumed that you were as well.
No, I am 100% Ukrainian.
Okay, well, that even more so then. I don't know how to ask this because it's one of those silly questions reporters ask, but how are you feeling right now?
That's an important question, Brad. In some ways, it's, you know, what's happening right now in Ukraine it's surreal. It's very hard to believe and kind of wrap my brain around it. And part of it has to do with the fact that many years ago, as a young man, I traveled to Ukraine when it was still the USSR. So I know what that country is like when it's not under its own rule. It was a very difficult time in Ukraine at that point. And, you know, I went to the country as part of a Ukrainian group. To think that things are possibly reverting back to that state is really hard to accept. You know, in Canada, we are a mosaic of people, and there is a very high population of Ukrainian people in Saskatchewan in particular. And so they are family and friends, and we all have relatives that are there who we know and have heard stories from them about what is happening. And it's, you know, it curdles your blood. So I think the difficulty is just trying to understand what's happening and then taking that a step further and trying to decide what you can do. And I think that can be a range from even just, you know, putting up a Ukrainian flag on your Facebook page. Some people think that's minimalistic. I think it's important. I think if every little bit of solidarity that people can show is important, because even if people are just scrolling through Facebook, and if I see that yellow and blue flag, I feel hope. And so everything from that to donating, to helping when refugees come to your community, to when I'm having my book launch, I'm bringing in a Ukrainian vocalist and I'm going to have her sing the Ukrainian national anthem. Small little things like that matter, just showing people caring for each other.
And I've got to agree with the Facebook thing. You know, a lot of people poo-poo when people put up a flag like that. And it is a small gesture, but it takes a few seconds to at least, it's a way to acknowledge that you care and you're concerned and that you're in solidarity. So it's simple. So why not? You know, and I think that's what people are missing when they condemn people that for doing that. What has been gut-wrenching to me and astounding to me is we've been watching the news reports from within the country since Russia was amassing at the borders. And that has been how many weeks now? About a month?
Oh, more than that. Yeah, I think it's five, six weeks.
Yeah. So we saw Ukraine as they were on the border, and we're seeing the Ukraine today, and it's gut-wrenching. Before our eyes, we were watching this country being devastated, and I can only imagine what it feels like. I mean, I can't imagine what it feels like to you to have such a close connection.
Yeah, well, you know, thanks for that, and it is very difficult, and you almost have to, at a certain point, you have to take time out, because it is so difficult to hear those stories and to see those images. And you sometimes just have to let it go for a little while, or else it becomes so much of a burden that the world gets dark and you think like nothing's ever going to be happy and joyful again. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people to know that those two things can coexist. Like there can be horrible things happening in the world, but you still should be able to be happy and to be glad that you have a new grandchild coming into your life, or that you can go spend a week in Mexico. Those two things can exist. It's just we have to think of what the hope is and where the change is going to happen. And I'm just so heartened by how really the entire world is standing up at this point and making their displeasure known. And I just have to believe that that is going to count for something, and it's probably not going to make changes quickly, but I think this has to be the beginning of the end of the kind of world where war, like actual war, can be an answer.
Yeah. And you hit on something that to me is very important that I have tried to get across to people, my opinion of it, and I'm not always successful. But when the Will Smith, Chris Rock thing happened, which I got just as sick of it as everybody else, but I saw a lot of people say, you know, this is getting so much attention, and, you know, there's things going on in the Ukraine and all these other things. And I'm like, life goes on elsewhere. If you watch the news reports in this amazing situation, the people in the Ukraine are going out shopping. They're having weddings. In the worst of tragedies, life still goes on. And the other option would be just to wallow in self-pity. And that doesn't do anyone any good. And
yeah, I agree with you, Brad. I mean, the world is not one thing. People aren't one thing. that's what diversity is all about. And I think it's the only shame is if there's ignorance or people ignoring important things, and that's not what's happening. This isn't being ignored. That's what's important. People care, and I feel that caring, and I think, you know, you and other people can see it happening around the world, and that's so positive. So we have to have that and hold on to that in our lives too, or else it's just it just makes things too hard to live through.
Back to the book. The Russell Quant series were mysteries, and then you did Adam Saint, which were suspense novels. Going to Beautiful is a thriller. Is there a reason why you chose to do a thriller, or is it that you like to play around with different subgenres within the genre of crime fiction?
Yeah, I will correct you, Brad. Going to Beautiful is actually more of a mystery. It is kind of blurring the genre a little, which, you know, I'm so glad you have had me on this show, Brad, because I know, one, you prefer series novels over standalones, and I don't see you as a person who likes a mystery that isn't always quite a mystery. I could be wrong about that. But this is a book that, and I had this conversation with my publisher about how do we frame this novel when we are giving this to booksellers and the warehouse and libraries. We're calling it kind of like a literary mystery, but it has, a lot of different traits to it that some people would say this is not a traditional mystery. But I kind of like to live there as a writer. I like to take a genre and expand it a little. And even with the Russell Quant mystery series, I mean, that was definitely a mystery series, but with every book, I really tried to give it a little bit of a spin. One book was a little bit more of a horror novel, and another book was, I think, probably, funnier than the others. And that's kind of a thing I like to do as a writer, just to sort of give a different feel or a tone to a book. With the Russell Quant series, I enjoyed doing that, and I could do it because it was a series and every book is tied together by those characters. With Going to Beautiful and the book before that, Set Free, which was also a standalone, that's much more difficult to do. So I think you kind of have to decide at the beginning, again, asking yourself, why do I write, and then create that, within that one book. It's something that I battle with a little bit, the whole series versus standalone. And the next book that I have coming out is the potential beginning of a new series. But it's been really a good experience for me as a writer to write these last two books as standalones. It's a different skill set, and I've had a good time writing them and figuring out how to write them, but I have a heck of a time trying to decide where they fit in the genre.
And actually, I'm not opposed to standalone novels. I think sometimes it's exactly what a novel needs. I've been working on, well, I have one I have actually halfway written and I hope to finish someday, and another one I have a million notes on. So I'm not opposed to them. I think the reason why I like mysteries is purely selfish. If I enjoy a book, I want it to keep going. So that's all.
Yep. Nope. I hear what you say. And there's even, I've had some thoughts about Going to Beautiful and extending it into sort of a trilogy. And it's a possibility. And I've kind of talked with my publisher and agent about the idea of maybe you write three books in this trilogy and visit this same group of characters every 5 years. And there's something about that appeals to me, thinking that you visit these characters with an extended period of time in between. And, a number of the characters in the books are older people, and trying to visit them again when they're, instead of being 60, they're now 65 or 70. To me, that opens up, this whole beautiful basket of things that I can investigate and write about.
So I want to talk about a big thing that you did in your life. After graduating college, with 3 degrees, I may add, you worked for 10 years as a CPA. And my dad, by the way, was a controller, managed an accounting department. So I can't picture him ever writing a book. But anyway, so after 10 years as a CPA, you then, dun, 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 you did something I would guess millions of people dream of. You chucked a comfortable, I presume stable job to pursue a dream, a passion. So you lost your mind and started writing full time. How much fear was involved in that?
Well, you know, Brad, I have to say, other than a little bit of situational fear, for a few moments after I locked my office door at Ernst & Young and started writing the following morning, very little fear. Because it was something that was such a long time coming. Like, I'm sure you've talked to a lot of writers on this show who, you know, have wanted to write ever since they were kids. And I was certainly one of those people. But what overtook me as I got older is that sense of responsibility that I've got to get a job where I, you know, wear a suit and carry a briefcase. And that's the direction I went. I think if I was a braver young man, I might have tried writing when I was 19 or 20. So by the time I was ready for it, I had thought a lot about it. I, you know, always had that underlying, you know, sense of wanting to do it and this passion that wasn't being fulfilled. And I tried to fulfill it in so many different ways that weren't writing, but it wasn't ever enough. So fortunately, you know, I had a very supportive spouse. I had a wonderful boss I worked for a firm called Ernst & Young. And when I went in to tell her, you know, and imagine that, you know, one of your senior auditor walks in and says, you know, by the way, I'm leaving, I'm going to start writing books. Instead of her saying, well, you know, when you want to come back, she said, if you ever want to come back, I will always have a job for you. And that was such a powerful thing to say to someone who's about to take a leap, because I felt I had this big safety blanket that I could land on. So not only a supportive spouse, but I had a career to go back to if I needed to. So there wasn't a lot of fear. There was just that joy that I talked about earlier. It just came bursting out of me. So when, you know, for that first day, I sat in my, you know, home office, and I knew that my entire day and my job for the foreseeable future was just to write and to create, I was so happy and joyful, and, you know, probably remain so to this day. It was so fulfilling. So there wasn't a lot of fear. I think there was a moment where I sort of thought, what did I just do? Mm-hmm. But it did not last at all. And then fortunately, it worked out for me.
Well, you and her had been together for, I think, 8 years around that time period. I'm probably in the right ballpark. And you said he was supportive. But was there a point where he said, are you sure about this?
You know, surprisingly not. And I think it was probably because he was just so tired of me every year saying the same stuff. So we had this thing where, you know, usually sometimes in January we'd escape, you know, frozen cold tundra of Saskatchewan and go to some hot location and sit on the beach and drink too many margaritas. And we would plan the next year and set our goals. And I would always say, you know, okay, this year I'm going to try writing a little more. I'm going to just try it. And every year I would repeat the same thing. And it was actually him who eventually said, like, just shut up and do it. And he
sounds like my husband.
Yes. And so he was the first, he was the impetus, really. I don't know how soon I would have come to it myself, but he gave me the freedom to try. And, you know, and bless his heart, he's never gone back on that, and he's never gone back of the promise of saying he'd never let me starve. and has always been that supportive. So it's I've been very fortunate in that way.
I don't remember what it was. I think it was last night I said something to my husband. He goes, you've brought this up 3 times now. I don't even remember what it was. He said, Chet, why don't you just do it. So I totally get where he's coming from. you took the risk and left your job, and your very first novel, you were a finalist for a Canadian Writers Award of Excellence. It had a different, it was a man's name back when you won it.
Yes, exactly.
But it's the Canadian Crime Writers Award of Excellence. That was your very first novel. And then your second novel, after taking this crazy jump, won a Lambda Literary Award.
Yes.
For gay mystery. Is that anything you possibly imagined was going to happen? And what was your reaction to that?
Well, it was a very heady time. And it, particularly when you have taken a really huge risk in your life, to have it rewarded in that way, of course, just feels so wonderful. I think the important thing that happened at that junction in my career was actually because of my previous career. You know, working as an auditor and accountant, I dealt with a lot of businesses, and I knew that marketing and promotion is key. I dealt with, you know, a lot of companies that even if they thought they built the best piece of machinery, if nobody knew about it, it really wasn't such a good piece of machinery after all. I knew that with this career, I had to apply the same principles. So even though I think, you know, half of my career is the creative side and building and creating this book, the other side, the business side, is just as important. And key to that is promotion and publicity. And for writers, sometimes that's tough. You know, we are kind of insular and we kind of want to write a book and throw it out there and hope for the best. But when things started happening, and particularly the Lammy win, I knew I needed to take advantage of that. And I really, you know, I'll forever be grateful for that win, because that really propelled the rest of my career, because I was able to use that as a springboard to really increase my visibility as an author outside of Canada and in the US. Like, I started touring with Russell Quant Books in the US after that. And that was, in some ways, maybe a crazy thing to do. But, you know, I did a whole tour through Texas with a gay mystery. That beginning was such a boon to me. And I think I am where I am today because of those early successes.
Well, and it wasn't just those two. Tell me if I get this right. Flight of Aquavit?
Flight of Aquavit, yes.
Aquavit, okay. Including that book, which was a winner, 6 of the 8 Russell Quant books were nominated for Lammys. Pat yourself on the back. That's the least you can do. And more than that, wrap your arms around yourself and spin in your chair and say, we.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to do it right now.
All right.
No, it was wonderful. And I, you know, I always made an effort. Well, Herb and I made an effort of always going to the ceremonies, because it was just so much fun to go to, you know, 1 year it was in New York, another time it was in Washington. It was so fun to go to those ceremonies. And I always tried to sneak my way on stage as a presenter or something, just to have that experience. It was, it was a pretty heady time.
Well, given that the Quant Mysteries did so well and popular, it's been a number of years since you've written. I think that's been a decade since you've written any of those. Is there any chance we'll see him come back?
You know, I never say never. I think with the Russell Quant books, I feel so good about where I left Russell and all of those characters that if there never is another book, I will feel good about it. But it's amazing how even to this day, I will get emails from people asking that question. So I have this very good feeling that if there were to be another Russell Quant, it would be warmly received. I would only want to do it if there is a story that I wanted to tell. As time passes, I could see that happening more and more, because again, going back to something that you and I talked about earlier, I always like to age my characters along with the books. So Russell would be in a whole different point in his life. In the last book, he was, you know, finally in a relationship. And so now that is a relationship that he, you know, hopefully will have been in for a fair number of years, or maybe not, who knows. So there would be a lot of interesting things from a character perspective to write about, and those are the types of things that appeal to me.
I'm going to give you a suggestion. You don't have to listen to me.
I listen to everything you say, Brad. Hold on. I'm going to get a pen. Write this down. This is gold.
I don't know why this came to me, but it jumped out of me like, I would love to see this happen. In your next standalone, in the most tense moment, have Russell do a walk-on cameo. And then see the scene.
I love doing that sort of stuff. I think you know that. So Neil Plaxey, who I know you've had on the show, and he's a good friend of mine, and he and I did a bit of a crossover in a short story with Russell Quant and his chemo character, and also in one of the Russell Quant books, I bring his chemo character into the story. A manuscript that I did write that I didn't end up publishing did sort of exist in the same timeline as Russell Quant, and I did bring him on as a bit of a side character. So that's very possible. You're a genius, Brad.
I know. And now that you mention it, I did read the you're in the Neil Plaxey crossover. I really enjoyed this.
Yes, you know, it was fun.
Yeah, that actually I think was my first introduction to your novels.
Okay, wow.
Or to your stories. Yeah. Now, there's been a lot of discussion I think since Marshall's been on, about the whole plotter and pantser thing. And that was a few weeks ago, about a month and a half ago, I think.
I heard that.
It's my understanding that you are a plotter. You do an outline. What I find more interesting, though, is that you write detailed biographies of your characters. How detailed are they? And how detailed are they?
Well, for the main characters, they are very detailed. Like, they can be pretty hefty documents. The way I think about it is that I want to know everything about those people until the very moment that they show up on a page in my book. And it, you know, it's, I think the reason is obvious. It's, I need to know them so well so that as I put them in various circumstances and situations, that I know exactly how they're going to react. If I don't, I don't think it'll come off as realistic. And so, you know, if I have a biography that's, you know, let's say it's 20 pages long, you know, probably 85% of that will never show up in a book, but I need to know it.
Is there information that you have in your biographies that you purposely hold back? And the reason I'm asking is, I've done a lot of interviews lately. I think it was with Bud Gundy last week that I said, my character, Mitch, I've only have two novels, but I plan on it going further someday.
You keep on saying that.
I know.
We're all waiting.
I know. It is coming. I mentioned that I have the biography, but I'm holding back information. For example, I know what his parental situation is. But I haven't shared that with the readers because there may come a time when I'm writing a novel and I need to either have both his parents alive or one of them dead or both of them dead. And so they haven't even been mentioned. Do you do the same? Do you keep that type of thing in mind?
Absolutely. Yes. And it's those types of things I believe that make a series richer. Because when you do finally bring up the parents, if you ever do, it'll seem like nothing to you because you've known the history from book one. And it'll just seem, and because it seems so right to you and natural to you because you know these people and their history, it'll come off on the page that way. Whereas if you just suddenly kind of, you know, in book four of the Mitch O'Reilly series decide, oh, I should put something in here about the mom and dad, I think that'll come off fake, you know. So I think the way you're doing it and the way I hope I do it does pay off. And there's, you know, as I said, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that go into biographies that may never end up coming out. But when you need them and that moment arises and you go like, you know, this is the best place that I want to say something about Mitch's dad, and you have that material already ready, that's the sweet spot. That's going to feel so good. Brad, let me ask you this. Have you ever listened to what readers have said to you? And maybe it's about Mitch, I know there's just the two books, but did you have feedback on the first book and you thought, oh, you know, maybe I should take that into account when I'm writing the second one or as you're plotting your third one? Do you listen to that type of stuff? Or are you really set on where you want to go? And if it's not what the readers want, then to heck with them.
Oh my gosh. That is so funny that you asked this. In my discussion with Marshall, I said that I don't read my reviews. And he said, well, I read my reviews because I want I want to know what they have to say. So I want to clarify to people out there, I try not to read my reviews, but I do have, actually, I'll admit it, it's Justine. Justine reads my reviews for me, and she gives me a synopsis of saying, if somebody just has a nasty comment, I don't need to hear it. But if she sees a theme, she'll let me know what that theme is.
Interesting.
So I do listen to those. Now, I will admit, I'm not the strongest of people, so sometimes I do go and read them. And the reason it's interesting that you brought it up is I just asked this question of both Marshall Thornton and Jeffrey Round. And it has to do with my second novel. Something happened in the relationship in my second novel, and a reader wrote a review in Goodreads that said, they hope I wasn't doing the same thing that Jeffrey Round did and Marshall Thornton did. I won't go into detail on that because I don't want to do a spoiler in their novel. And I think I know where I'm going with mine. But
oh, come on, spoil it.
Well, there's a relationship that starts in the first book, and the second book, it starts to get a little better and then goes sour. Let me put it that way. And people are worried they're going to break up. And I have two ideas, one they do and one they don't, and I don't know the direction I'm going to go. I am leaning towards one of them, and I'm keeping my mouth shut. But here's what bothers me about that I read that. Because whatever decision I make, I'm concerned I won't know whether it was really my decision. So if the person really wanted this couple to stay together. So if I say, okay, I am going to have them stay together, I think that's the best storyline. It's going to be in the back of my head, like, did I do that because that's what they wanted? Because they had several other people comment, yeah, I feel the same way. Or if I choose to have them break up, am I going to say, well, I did that in retaliation because I didn't want that reader to tell me what to do.
This sounds just like life.
Yes. I am really concerned at this moment that once I make that decision, I won't know whether I made that decision or not.
Yes.
So, but you know what? I'll just do it. So,
well, let me suggest this to you, Brad, because I had a situation a little similar to that. And if, you know, you've said that you're a plotter, not unlike me, those characters are pretty firmly formed. Like, you know who Mitch is. And I would suggest to you that if you try and do something with him or his relationship that doesn't feel right for that character, you're going to know it even as you're writing it. Like, you may never get as far as actually publishing a book that has something in it that doesn't feel right for that character, or, you know, where that place in your big brain he was born in. With Russell Quant, I really, particularly early in the series, wanted to keep him single. Like, I wanted to decide that even though he wasn't, you know, a young man, I think he was 30 when I started the series, I wanted to show that as a viable lifestyle choice to stay single and be happy. And a lot of readers did not like that. And it kind of ticked me off a little bit that people kept on saying, like, where's the love interest? Like, where's the boyfriend? And I, you know, I quickly realized that it was out of the goodness of their hearts that they cared about Russell so much that they wanted him to be happy. And to them, being happy meant being coupled. Eventually, I started to capitulate a little bit to that idea, and I started creating men that I thought, here's his Romeo. It didn't work. Like, I think I went through like three or four love interests, and I swear to you, Brad, when I first started writing them, my intent was that this was going to be his long-term love. And they kept on breaking up almost without me deciding it. Like, but I just knew Russell so well that character just told me that, you know, nice try, but no, this isn't him.
I'm going to toss something out at you, given your experience, something that's been very frustrating to me. And if you've read A Body in the Bathhouse and you have not read A Body on the Hill, spoiler alert, you may want to tune out because I'm going to tell you something about A Body on the Hill. Mitch has PTSD, and I interviewed quite a few people in the military, primarily that spent time in Afghanistan, which is where Mitch spent time, that had PTSD when I wrote the character. And I got sober 18 years ago. And I can tell you, when I got sober, my life got worse. Because for the first time, I had to look at the damage I created. So, and I thought, I bet that's similar. So I went and I talked to people who have PTSD. And I said, when you started getting therapy and started getting help, did this happen? And they were like, yeah, that's exactly what happened. So in book two, you know, book one ends where Mitch is going to get help. Book two, Mitch is really not doing well. And I based that on the reality I know. And I got probably the most negative feedback. People still like the book, fortunately, at least most of the reviews I read. But the biggest negative feedback I got was, what the hell was the deal? He got worse. He didn't learn anything from the growth in the first book. And yes, he did. He learned that he needs to do something. And when you're doing something about all that, your life goes to shit for a while. I didn't know how to explain that without explain. Actually, I do have it mentioned very briefly in the book, and I wish I had mentioned it further, but I didn't want it to be a lecture on what it's like to be in recovery.
Yeah. That's so interesting, Brad. And I wonder if it's similar to what I was just talking about, where people really like Mitch. You know, like, they want him to be well, they want him to be happy. And you sort of showed him moving into a direction that made everybody have an expectation that, now he's going to get help, things are going to be good. And instead, you sort of explode this bomb over them, which I love that, because it's so true to life. But, you know, what you just said about, you know, when you went into recovery, that life went to shit, that's not everyone's expectation, and that's not what they want from you, but it's real. And I think, even though people might be saying negative things about it, I would take it in a very positive way, because they like this character you've created. They want him to be well, and they want him to be happy. You're just giving us a very realistic view of a life, and they're going to get it. Can you tell us a little bit about what direction you're taking him in book three, or do you know yet?
Yes, actually, book three is, I'm pretty deep into it. So for those of you that are really pissed off at me, I am in there. Book three is more lighthearted on purpose, not just because of what I wanted with Mitch. I will say that he is advancing. He's still dealing, I mean, you know, it's PTSD. People spend the rest of their lives in therapy on it. So that's always going to be an issue, but he is expanding his horizons. He's always going to be a smart-ass, cocky fellow, because I've already established that was the way he was before he went to war, but maybe not as big of an asshole as some people have been concerned that he is.
Yeah. So. Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that, because I think those two things can coexist. You can write a book that's a little bit lighthearted, or maybe more lighthearted than the first two, but he can still be having these issues. It just isn't the focus of that particular book.
Yeah, and by light, it's not going to be a wacky comedy, but which I hope someday to do a wacky comedy mystery series. But no, this is it. It's just more lighthearted. It's really more the environment and the other characters. And I love writing all the other characters. It's the best thing I love about mysteries.
Yes, well, you do it so well. Like what's the name of the woman who hires him in the very first book? Oh, do you remember her name?
Eve.
Was it Eve? Yeah. And she wasn't a big part of the book, but I just thought she was such a wonderful, horrible character. You know, she didn't have a lot of page count to her, but I thought you really created someone unique, and I loved every time that she kind of showed up again. I like that about your writing.
I adored her because I loved hating her, and I probably will bring her back someday. Who knows when, but I probably will bring her back. She was fun to write.
Oh, yeah. I bet.
And because, you know, like all of us, I know her. You are good peeps. We've already established that. You were named Saskatoon Citizen of the Year in 2014. And then last year, this was exciting to me, you became a geographical location. I did a search on Google Maps and I found you.
Oh, did you?
Right. I did. I didn't even write the name of your town. I wrote Bidulka Park. And Google Maps took me right to Saskatoon, where I saw Bidulka Park and Bidulka Park North. That's like, wow. What was your reaction when you got that news?
Well, first thing I thought of, you're like, how the heck old am I to have a park named after me? No, it was really, I mean, obviously, it was such an amazing thing to happen. And, you know, I think, you know, that along with being named Citizen of the Year for our city, and that was a co-honoree of myself and my husband, Herb, and it's the first time that had ever happened in our city's history that a gay couple has been recognized in that way. And when things like that happen, it's not something that I stay quiet about, and it's not because I want to toot my own horn personally, but I can't help but think that there are young LGBTQ youth out there who hear that story and see on the news that an out gay man has had a park named after him in the city of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is not New York or, you know, or Toronto. That is very meaningful to me, that there can be this recognition and that there's some kid out there who's going, oh, wow, like it really does get better. You can hear those words and you can say those words, but that's a geographic, as you put it, example of how it can happen. And it's a very public thing. I think that's important. And wherever any of us can show up in that way, I think those are important moments.
Well, I want to tell you, when I looked at them, I zoomed in, and they're two very different parks. Bidulka Park North is very cute with a playground. And what I thought was, I'm sorry, long after you're gone, children will be playing in that playground in a park that honored a gay man in a small Canadian town. It sounds well-deserving. So now's the fun part.
It's all been fun, Brad.
Okay, it's time for Awkward Questions Authors Get. You know what this is about. It's questions that we frequently get. And I've been forgetting to mention that, you know, originally when I started the show, I made them up. And then later I did a survey of authors and I said, give me some questions that you've been asked. And those are the ones I've been using lately. And some are really bizarre. So if you're going to hang on, I'm going to spin the wheel and we're going to see what question you get.
I'm ready.
Okay. I like this question.
Uh-oh. That's got me worried.
Why do you hate women?
Oh, so that really shocked me. Wow. Oh my gosh. Well, I would just have to very, very quickly and vociferously respond that I absolutely do not hate women. I love women and I have them as mentors and friends. And it's been rumored that my mother is a woman and my sister is a woman. And I just think that's a horrible question, Brad. Oh my gosh.
I don't know who submitted that to me. I wish I knew because I would like to ask them what the circumstances were.
Yes.
Because I think my reaction would have been, once I got my chin back off the floor, would have been just to walk away.
I would have, but I'm connected to my computer talking to you. But that is interesting. So do you think it's, would someone ask that question of a gay man just thinking that because you're a gay man, you must hate women? Is that where that would come from?
That is my guess. It was somebody incredibly ignorant.
Yes, yes. Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, ignorance is, it's all about teaching someone the truth.
There you go. I am so glad you contacted me to come back
or
to be on the show. Whenever the next book comes out, or maybe just sometime to chat, I'd love to have you back. This has been fun.
Yes, it really has. Thank you, Brad.